Welcome to the first annual Danilo Husar-Struk Memorial Lecture. This lecture honors Danilo Struk, who was professor of Ukrainian language and literature here at the University of Toronto.
He was the editor-in-chief of the Encyclopedia of Ukraine, and he was the associate director of the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies. But first and foremost tonight, we remember him as a great lover of literature and a man who worked consistently to further the goals that our program had set itself. Tonight's speaker is also a very prominent personality in Ukrainian scholarship. He is one of the best known specialists in Ukrainian literature in the world today, both in Ukraine and outside of it. He is Professor Marko Pavlyushyn, professor at the Department of Slavic Studies at Monash University. He is the director of the Center of European Studies there. He's also the president of the New Zealand and Australia Association of Slavics. He is very well known as a prolific author on a great variety of topics in Ukrainian literature. His best-known work, perhaps, in his most recent book, a collection of his essays in Ukrainian, entitled Kanon ta Ikonostas. He is also, I am proud to say, the translator of Yuri Andruhovich's Recreation, a publication that CIUS Press published. He is the editor or co-editor of a range of publications, including such titles as Text and the Encyclopedia of Ukrainian Diaspora Australia volume. Tonight, he speaks to us on a subject that has become very prominent in Ukrainian literature and one very deserving of our attention. He will be speaking on Olha Kobylyanska, a figure who herself has been the subject of a few recent publications. Two I will mention in particular, a collection of translated stories by Kobylyanska and Yaroshenska, But the Lord is Silent, in the series Women's Voices in Ukrainian Literature, translated by Roma Franco, and a forthcoming publication in our own CIUS Press of Mary Skripnik's translation of the novel of Nedelyu Rano Villa Kupala. I think I am taking too much of your time. Let me call on Marko Pavlyushyn to deliver his talk.
Ladies and gentlemen, my topic is rereading the classics in a post-Soviet world, the case of Olha Kobylyanska. One of the self-evident tasks of post-Soviet literary criticism, especially in the successor states of the former Soviet Union, is the re-examination, reinterpretation, and re-evaluation of the corpus of texts that is the object of this scholarly discipline. Over and above the general obligation of all humanities scholarship to reconsider the seemingly familiar in the light of new theories and in the context of our own changing cultural environment, post-Soviet literary scholarship has to correct previous omissions and distortions. It is only a little less self-evident that these tasks are more easily named than done. Soviet intellectual models have lost their authority and therefore utility. But which of the available theoretical models can and should a scholar in a formerly Soviet country seek to use? Which tasks of rediscovery and reinterpretation should be given priority? Even more fundamentally, what ideas about the relationship between literature, literary scholarship, and society should be assumed as the basis for these tasks? In the economically impoverished post-Soviet environment, what institutional and personal resources are available for their performance. These are questions which have no general answers for the whole of the post-Soviet space. For the literary scholarship of formerly metropolitan and in many respects still hegemonic Russia, the tasks of self-reinvention are different from those which confront the formerly dominated cultures, each with its own histories and present. The following observations, therefore, are rather specific. They focus on the situation in Ukraine, which should not be taken as analogous to or symptomatic of situations elsewhere. The response of Ukrainian literary scholarship to the end of the Marxist-Leninist monopoly over ideology, about 1989, and the advent of state independence for Ukraine, 1991, has been more spontaneous and random than inspired by any articulated vision or driven by the logic of any debate. A great deal of the energy of middle-generation literary scholars during this period has been invested into the republication of texts formerly proscribed and written by persecuted writers, especially in the 1920s and 1930s on the one hand, the 1960s to 80s on the other. Perhaps the most impressive outcome of these endeavors is the complete works in six volumes of the repressed poet Vasil Stus, who died in a prison camp as late as 1985. New literary histories as the basis for new textbooks and new pedagogies have been required. They have not been forthcoming in overwhelming numbers, but those that have been published, on the whole, have been conservative in their theoretical profile, limiting themselves, where possible, to statements of empirical fact and substituting the narrative of progress towards a communist social order with the no less emphatic narrative of progress towards the embodiment of the national idea in political reality. Younger scholars have sometimes tried their hand at a literary criticism informed by Western, especially post-structuralist, thought and practice. Sometimes they have produced impressive work, but all too often they have crossed the line that separates the fruitful application of novel concepts and models from the incantation of jargon. Several causes have contributed to this state of affairs. Inadequate knowledge of the source texts, exacerbated by the impoverishment of libraries. A paucity of translations, exacerbated by the sometimes eclectic decisions of publishers concerning which theoreticians and which texts to translate. Inadequate exposure to examples of good critical practice using the Western theories, and a loss of bearings by the publishing outlets as to what does and what does not represent good literary scholarship. Only one school has emerged that groups a number of practitioners around a particular approach, a small group of feminist literary critics based in the Institute of Literature of the National Academy of Sciences, where there is now a Center for Gender Studies. The group appears to be inspired more by the institutional force and presence of feminism in the Western academe than by the refinements of its theoretical apparatus. The writings of Vera Aheyeva and the late Solomia Pavlichko are based on a familiar historicist approach to literary scholarship, leavened by common sense alertness to matters overlooked and injustices done by the patriarchally dominated institution of literary scholarship. In particular, this circle has contributed provocative rereadings of Ukrainian modernism. Pavlichko herself, as well as Tamara Hundorova, and of one of the canonical authors of Ukrainian 19th and 20th century literature, Lesya Ukrainka, by Vera Aheyeva. And the issue of the need to utilize the literary canon as the starting point for culturally productive debate has been raised on a number of occasions, mainly by scholars working in the field of Ukrainian literary studies in Western countries. While much has been done to augment the canon with unjustly silenced voices, there are very few readings that ask whether the already canonized, including some exponents of socialist realism, deserve their traditional places in the canon. Equally few and far between are readings that challenge the received images of canonical writers. These few studies include the Harvard professor George Grabovich's critiques of the still prevailing populist accounts of Shevchenko, Ivan Franko, and Lesya Ukrainka. There are three main reasons why questioning the canon in contemporary Ukraine is important. The first is ethical. From the perspective of human justice and truth, it is not without significance whether artists and their works enjoy respect or suffer oblivion, or whether works judged by certain criteria to be good are celebrated less than others which, by these same criteria, are inferior. The second reason is grounded in the internal needs of literary scholarship as an intellectual discipline. There is a need to take advantage of present access to relatively undistorted empirical knowledge in order to test whether the possession of these new facts alters perceptions of canonized authors and works. There is also a need to articulate judgments concerning items in the canon on the basis, for the first time, of freely made ethical and aesthetic judgments. The third reason is pragmatic. The teaching of the Soviet literary canon helped reinforce ideological instruction. It instilled ideas of relative cultural value, including the relative value of the metropolitan and the colonial cultures. It confirmed the belief that there was one acceptable consensual view concerning every issue, and that individual views, insofar as they diverged from that consensus, had no status or were aberrant. Teaching the canon encouraged the habits of prejudging texts, and therefore of reading them inattentively. If one examines instruction aids for teachers of literature, in particular the journal Ukrainska mova i literatura v shkoli, later renamed Devo Slovo, one sees very clearly the changes that had been made in the ideological interpretation of canonical works to privilege the new master narrative of nation formation. But one sees little evidence of any attempt to alter the overall purpose of studying literature. For example, to make it part of a strategy of preparing individuals to develop skills of observation and discussion preparatory to independent value judgments. I would like in this presentation to consider a canonical Ukrainian writer, the woman novelist Olha Kobylyanska, 1863 to 1942. I would like to give an account of the genesis of the prevailing perception of her works and their significance in Ukrainian literary history, as well as some recent feminist contributions to her reassessment. I would like to draw attention to several significant dimensions of Kobylyanska's work that still remain undiscussed. And finally, to offer the sketch of an alternative account and an even more tentative sketch for a re-evaluation. Because this is a lecture dedicated to the memory of the late Danilo Husar-Struk, I hope also to keep in mind the values and intentions reflected in Danilo Struk's literary criticism. Struk, it seems to me, was concerned above all with doing justice to literary works of merit and distinction. Identifying a work with exceptional aesthetic qualities was for him a first step which any competent critic performed intuitively. The exposition of the particular qualities of the work perceived to be excellent, he saw as the main and proper domain of literary scholarship. In writing about canonical writers, and Stefanik is a case in point here, Struk sought to envision them afresh, paying attention to how they were made and how they worked and what they meant for him. Often, the process involved disposing of venerable literary critical clichés. So, in this spirit, let us consider Kobylyanska. Kobylyanska is a second-order classic in Ukrainian literature, not one of the big three, Shevchenko, Franco, Lesya Ukrainka, but certainly in the largish cohort of 19th and 20th century writers that, in the consensual imagination, follows at a respectful distance behind. Of her own generation, perhaps Mikhailo Kotyubinsky, Vasil Stepanek, perhaps also Marko Cheremshina and Les Martovich. She has been the subject of some reinterpretation, partly because of her relevance to the phenomenon of Ukrainian modernism, which has been the most seriously discussed issue in Ukrainian literary scholarship in the last decade. Partly because of her interest to feminist critics, who have also played the main role in the study of modernism. And this has meant that Kobylyanska is mentioned often when a general point needs to be illustrated in survey studies, which occasionally also contain short analyses of aspects of her works. There have, however, been few, if any, sustained larger studies that would challenge the old orthodoxies and augment with argument and evidence. No new, robust understanding of her works has emerged, and no real attempt has been made to describe them more accurately and more completely than was possible in the Soviet era. Kobylyanska was the author of 8 novels, including 2 that are especially celebrated, Zemlya, 1902, and V nedelyu rano zilla kopala, 1909, as well as numerous shorter prose works, the most notable of which are perhaps Nekulturna and Vals Melancholique, both completed in 1897. She lived all of her life in Bukovina, which during Kobylyanska's lifetime was a part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, then of Romania, and finally, in part, of the Ukrainian SSR. She began writing in German in the mid-1880s, but soon, influenced by her friends, including 2 of the most important West Ukrainian feminists, switched to Ukrainian. At the turn of the century, Kobylyanska's early works, especially the novel Tsarivna, became bones of contention in a heated critical dispute. Young modernist critics and writers, among them Ostap Lutsky, Mykola Yevshan, and Hnat Chodkevich, claimed her as one of their own and praised her for, allegedly, championing art for art's sake, cultivating an aristocratism of the spirit, abandoning populist themes, and spurning populist politics. Populist critics, foremost among whom was Serhiy Yefremov, castigated her for the same alleged qualities. Subsequently, Kobylyanska distanced herself from the modernists, a maneuver that facilitated her integration into the Soviet canon of Ukrainian realist writers. The received account of Kobylyanska is formulated in such authoritative locations as the introduction to the 5-volume edition of her works, 1962-63, the chapter dedicated to her in the 8-volume Historia Ukrainskoye Literature, and the entry in the Ukrainska Literaturna Encyclopedia, the last of these published already on the eve of Ukrainian independence. This account runs more or less as follows. Kobylyanska began with some feminist works that were interesting but of limited importance. Then came 2 populist masterpieces, of which Zemlya was, I quote, one of the finest works about the village, not only in Ukrainian, but in world literature, unquote, whereas V nedelyu rano zilla kopala was, quote, one of the notable phenomena of the new Ukrainian prose of the early 20th century, unquote. That's the Ukrainian Literary Encyclopedia. Her other novels, set in middle-class milieus, Nioba, 1904, Across the Bridge, 1911, Cherez Kladku, and Za Situaciami, In Pursuit of Circumstances, 1913, were less significant from the point of view both of content and aesthetic achievement, while Apostol Cherny, Apostle of the Masses, 1926, was altogether something of an embarrassment whose plot deserved retelling only in the vaguest and most general terms. Well, this account was not wholly the invention of Soviet literary history. Populist pre-1917 critics, Olha Kubilanska herself, and the nationally minded public opinion of Ukrainian intellectual society in interwar Western Ukrainian lands contributed to a good deal of it. The reception of Kubilanska passed through three broad phases. The first ended with the debate concerning her modernism. Kubilanska wrote in relative isolation from the Ukrainian literary tradition, and in her works of the 1890s, echoes of early European modernism could easily be identified. Feminist, Nietzschean, Darwinist, and socialist ideas, and décadence as a literary style and a set of thematic preoccupations. Nervous hypersensitivity and neurosis, world weariness, aestheticism, music, and sexuality, to name just a few. In fact, the publication in 1982 of Kubilanska's remarkable diary showed that this material reflected the author's own real and imagined experiences as much as it did the modish concerns of the fin de siècle. But it was the familiar, classifiable, and categorizable modernist, in inverted commas, Kubilanska, who became the football in the debate between Yefremov and his modernist opponents. Perhaps in response to this, Kubilanska, who in her earliest autobiographical note, dated 1898, had identified herself as a practitioner of art for art's sake, in her subsequent autobiographies, 1903, 1921-22, and 1927, played down her modernist credentials and strove to put as populist a slant upon her writing as possible. On the whole, this self-interpretation did not contradict the interpretation that interwar non-Soviet critics in Western Ukraine and in the emigration wanted to place upon her works. Some reading her as a belated romantic or neo-romantic, Metrokozy, others finding the influence of Nietzsche in her works to have been merely superficial, Luka Lutsiv. In Soviet Ukraine, where a collected edition of Kubilanska's works began to appear in the 1920s, critics were initially at a loss as to an ideologically appropriate line of interpretation, and some, therefore, took refuge in brilliant displays of philological erudition, for example, Pavlo Filipovich. A certain cult of Kubilanska emerged in Western Ukraine, where several of her works entered the curriculum of Ukrainian language schools, and the 40th anniversary of her activity as a writer was celebrated with considerable pomp. The third phase in Kubilanska's reception commenced with the first Soviet occupation of northern Bukovina in 1940. The official Soviet response to Kubilanska had cooled in the 1930s, and the Ukrainian SSR government had stopped the pension which it had bestowed upon her in 1927. The new regime could equally well have labeled her a bourgeois nationalist on the basis of her newest work, Apostol Cherny, or hailed her as a critical realist. In the event, it was decided to follow the latter path. And the archival record of the high-level discussion in which this decision must have been made would make for fascinating study. Perhaps it was felt that more would be gained for Soviet public relations by embracing an existing authority. The paralyzed and ill old lady, who by then was capable of very little independent action, was subjected to what must have been painful media attention and no less excruciating visits from the few Soviet Ukrainian writers who had escaped being murdered. She became the witting or unwitting author of a few statements welcoming the Soviet liberators and the new social order which they brought with them. After the war, the official codification of the Soviet understanding of Kubilanska took place along the lines described above. Professional literary scholarship demonstrated the usual combination of pro-regime servilism and cultural Ukrainophilism in dealing with her heritage. On the one hand, admirable work was done to collect, edit, annotate, and publish her opus. Two important editions saw the light of day during the Khrushchevian thaw, the three-volume edition of 1956 and its five-volume successor of 62-63. The critic Fedyr Pohrebennik was the unsung hero of this task. On the other hand, the work was presented to the reader, purged of those elements which could not be accommodated into the profile of a classic worthy of Soviet respect. Pohrebennik scrupulously tells us what is missing. In the letters, for example, intimate passages, as well as letters, quote, of no scholarly interest, unquote, and I think this means containing ideologically inappropriate statements. Of Kubilinska's 174 letters to her closest male friend, Osip Makovej, only 69 are published. In its published version, the diary, the single most revealing document of Kubilinska's emotional life as a young woman, is full of marks of ellipsis. Apostol Cherny was never published in Soviet Ukraine and had to wait until 1993 for its first Ukrainian publication. The official ideological judgment, articulated first by Oleh Babushkin and then reinforced by Pohrebennik, was that Kubilinska had her heart, politically speaking, in the right place, though circumstances prevented her from achieving the insights needed for a truly progressive analysis of society. And several of her works are, unfortunately, not free of contradictions. In several respects, however, she was an innovator in the context of Ukrainian literature, introducing the woman question for the first time as a literary theme and furnishing in Zemlya an outstanding representation of social conditions in the Ukrainian village. Teachers were encouraged to teach Zemlya as a text exposing the evils of private ownership, showing the motif of fratricide as a symptom of capitalism's deleterious effect upon the human psyche. There was no ideological struggle to speak of over Kubilinska between Soviet critics and their post-war émigré counterparts. In the West, some of the more interesting interwar criticism was republished, and occasional studies on specialized questions appeared, on Kubilinska's language and style, for example, by Alexandra Kopacz, or on the influence upon her of the popular 19th century German woman novelist Marlit by Anahalia Horbach. Until the 1990s, then, the image of Kubilinska was rather stable. The publication of the diaries in 1982, which even in expurgated form should have revolutionized the field, passed with scarcely a ripple. The only hint at a disturbance came in an essay by the dissident critic Ivan Zuba, whose 1965 essay on Kubilinska appeared in the émigré journal Suchasnist in 69. The article is more interesting as an Aesopian anti-colonial text than as a contribution to Kubilinska scholarship. Zuba provocatively compared Kubilinska's work directly with West and Central European counterparts, instead of locating her initially, as etiquette required, in the context of the brotherly Russian literature. His reflections on Kubilinska's feminism are a pretext, in fact, for the discussion of the role of third world feminisms in the anti-colonial struggle for national self-assertion. The coming of post-Soviet times ushered in a certain Kubilinska revisionism. The feminist redefinition of Ukrainian modernism led to no full-length analyses of Kubilinska's texts, but to the articulation of generalizations, sometimes more provocative than sustainable. Solomeya Pavlichko, in her Discourse of Modernism in Ukrainian Literature, for example, rather unhelpfully, I think, alleged that Kubilinska was disappointed in the common people and regarded them as, quote, something like the Nietzschean rabble, unquote. This view is pleasantly contrary to the Soviet consensus, and it goes well with Pavlichko's view of Kubilinska as an anti-populist, but the responsible assessment of the evidence would not support it. On the other hand, Pavlichko usefully brings into discussion themes that had never been previously articulated in print. For example, the patronizing and rather ungenerous attitude toward Kobylyanska of the authoritative men of Ukrainian culture, Franko and Yefremov. This, Pavlichko interprets as the consequence of a reaction of fear to the challenge that Kobylyanska's thematizing of sexuality may have represented to the conservative patriarchal order in Ukrainian culture, which Pavlichko believes Franko and Yefremov were dedicated to maintaining. Pavlichko also singled out for attention the special friendship between Kobylyanska and Lesya Ukrainka. The correspondence between the two women was exceptionally tender and affectionate, and couched in a private code in which they addressed each other as someone black and someone white. Pavlichko, in pointing out the erotic dimension of such language, set a cat among the pigeons. A journalist jeered in the newspaper Kievskie Vyedomosti that Ukrainians could get nothing right. Even their cultural icons turned out to be lesbians. The public outcry that erupted would reward careful analysis, so revealing it was, of colonial and anti-colonial attitudes in a post-colonial situation. In this context, it is sufficient to say that while passions raged about the image of Lesya Ukrainka, Kobylyanska, being only a second-order classic, was scarcely noticed. Nobody felt obliged to be offended on her behalf. Tamara Hundurova, in The World Made Self, Discourses of Ukrainian Modernism, a Postmodern Interpretation, writing at about the same time as Pavlichko, takes a more moderate position on most matters, proposing, for example, that Kobylyanska effects a modernist transformation of the populist science system, locating the modern, differentiated subject within the structure of pre-existent social myths. Hundurova, who in 1988 had contributed a study of Kobylyanska's neo-romantic dimension, underscores the mystical element of Kobylyanska's work, arguing the highly contestable thesis that Tsarivna in particular synthesizes a, quote, new model of communication that rests on forms of non-rational, spiritual, intuitive cognition, unquote. There is not the space here to debate these innovative post-Soviet conceptions of Kobylyanska. Suffice it to say that a critic trained in the tradition of close reading and accustomed to check the plausibility of claims against textual evidence might be forgiven for concluding that new ways have certainly been found of writing about Kobylyanska's texts without, however, necessarily first reading them. There may be reasons for this. Life is short, and Olha Kobylyanska is long. The fact remains, however, and Danilo Struk would have agreed with this wholeheartedly, that the first challenge of the post-Soviet period is to reread the texts, that is, to overcome the cultural inertia of prejudging them, of reading selectively to demonstrate a particular pre-existent viewpoint. This is a plea for rereading the classics, perhaps not even rereading them, but reading them for the first time. Criticism of every color has reflected on the social dimension of Kobylyanska's works, their treatment of feminist issues, their relationship to various cultural movements, their favored motifs, especially nature, art, and the artist, the structure of relationships between characters, and lately, their treatment of issues of sexuality. But the individual works have seldom been adequately described, let alone analyzed and interpreted. The most widely discussed novel, Zemlya, for example, has become the captive of a critical legend that has obscured the very thing that makes the work interesting and links it to the rest of Kobylyanska's opus. The point of departure for all interpretations without exception has been the assumption that the central event in Zemlya is the killing of a young peasant by his brother. But there is no unequivocal fratricide in the book, just as in real life, in the real life events on which the novel is based, the courts found the alleged perpetrator not guilty. The key question of the novel is not why Sava killed Mikhailo, nor is it why mobile phones go off when one is lecturing. Even in Ukrainian lit. Yeah. But whether Mikhailo in fact did so. And the central issue is therefore not the social or psychological causality that leads to crime, but the obscurity and uncertainty of human affairs which defy final knowledge. Whole dimensions of works, including important aspects of the way in which Kobylyanska obviously intended her writings to affect their public, go unnoticed because of the prevailing prejudices about her works. Because the prevailing prejudices about her works have no use for them. Here are a few examples. One, substantial space in the longer prose works is dedicated to the depiction of petty malice and tyranny, especially but not only exercised by older women against creative, sensitive, and arty heroines. The author obviously expects the reader to experience a special kind of pleasure from these incantations of words that hurt and humiliate, and are received by their addressees in mute suffering. We are supposed to enjoy these heroines who are frustrated and bottle up their anger, who punish themselves even more than others punish them, and who turn the other cheek not out of forgiveness, but in a complex strategy of exasperating the tormentor while luxuriating in their own anger and humiliation. Kobylyanska's heroines confess to, and these are quotations, some kind of sad pleasure or melancholy happiness. Is this a ploy of décadence, an invitation to the reader to participate in an unconfessed sadomasochism, identifying with the dominatrix or the submissive, or merely deriving pleasure from watching? One possible readerly reaction to such passages is a sense of disgust coupled with a desire to continue reading. A case could be made for regarding them as the components of a pornography of psychological violence. Two, pursuant to the above, hatred is an important component of the psychic world that Kobylyanska delineates. Hatred is a fact of life, and Kobylyanska's characters cherish it, nourish it, harbor it against others and direct it against themselves. Sometimes it has causes, sometimes it arises randomly and just as randomly disappears. Hatred can be, but need not be, a companion to the sense of superiority or inferiority that characters feel on account of their being strong or weak, artists or Philistines. The self-appointed Nietzschean Übermenschen in Kobylyanska's works, many of them women, not uncommonly hate the, quote, despicable, dull souls, the hyenas, unquote, whose stifling presence obstructs them. Three. Perhaps the most important object of desire in practically all of Kobylyanska's works, utterly overlooked by criticism, is happiness. Happiness in Kobylyanska's works, however, is a quite specific ideal. It is a sense of personal well-being resulting from a mutually desired heterosexual relationship that has been made socially real through the marriage contract. Happiness, therefore, depends on many contingencies. It is rare. When it comes, it does so unpredictably. It is easily undermined, and the human being must be eternally and humbly open to the possibility of it. Quote, I await happiness every day, every hour. Why is it that in all the radiance that thrills so luxuriously through my soul, there coils something like the crepe ribbon of mourning? Unquote. Or again, why is it that though the blood of the future flows in my veins, I have no future, no noon in my life? Well, happiness is a complicated thing in the middle classes and is almost never found there, though chance does secure some happy ends in Kobylyanska's novels. The novella Nekulturna is a portrait of a happy woman, a peasant who has few needs and is able to satisfy them all by her own efforts. She was once married on the spur of the moment to a man she did not know, and chance gave her 17 years of satisfactory married life. Now she sometimes allows men to live with her, but makes them leave if they do not please her. She lives in the mountains, and she savors the beauty of nature there. She has courage and no fear for the future, and this gives her power. Happiness like this is practically excluded, of course, if, in contrast to the heroine of The Uncultured One, one is cultured. 4. Ethnicity, ethnic identity, and race are important matters for Kobylianska. They were clearly part of the politics of everyday life in multi-ethnic Bukovina under each of the three regimes that Kobylianska experienced. With the exception of very few early critics, notable among them is Ahatanhil Krimsky, this has been demurely ignored by scholars. Kobylianska often tells her readers the nationality of her characters. One encounters Ukrainians, whom she calls in her earlier works Ruthenians, Rusyny. One encounters Germanized Ukrainians, Poles, Germanized Poles, Germans, Jews, Gypsies, Russians, Romanians, and people of mixed ethnic origin. Kobylianska's fascination for nationality would require careful study, and it would be premature to offer any but the most tentative observations about it. I would venture to say, nevertheless, that while the works record the prejudicial use of ethnic stereotypes in social practice, they do not themselves subscribe to explanatory models that present nationality as a cause or predictor of behavior. One finds many allusions in the works to the inheritance of physical or psychological features, to natural selection, to survival of the fittest, to biological strength and weakness, to inbreeding and miscegenation. Yet these reflections do not coalesce into a theory. More precisely, the fact that they resist systematization is congruent with the more general image of the world that emerges from Kobylianska's works, the world as unknowable, disconnected, bereft of predictable causes, and ultimately mysterious. 5. In contrast to their inconclusiveness on the nature and meaning of ethnicity, Kobylianska's works reflect fairly simple and clear, though evolving, views on the political goals appropriate for the Ukrainian nation. In the early works, the improvement of the social and cultural conditions of one's people is the duty of a self-respecting intellectual. Later, after the failed attempt at Ukrainian nation-state building in 1917-21, Kobylianska, like most intellectuals in West Ukrainian lands, believes in the naturalness and justice of the restoration of an independent Ukraine, the vision of which closes her last novel, Apostol Cherni. The national question, however, is far from the center of Kobylianska's concerns, and her views on the matter, as reflected in the works, are merely the mainstream ones of the society in which she lived. Now, these five lacunae in the description of Kobylianska's works, I believe, are among those that need to be filled before responsible interpretive work from whatever theoretical perspective is undertaken. Among the interpretations waiting to be made are feminist ones. The gender politics of Kobylianska's works, her particular ways of challenging the patriarchal domination of her society and culture, requires attentive critical study, as do the ways in which Kobylianska's texts structure her voice as a woman writer and as a woman using the patriarchal and populist codes available to her. Now, it's not my intention to preempt the properly complex feminist study of Kobylianska. What I can offer here is the outline of a common sense traditionalist life and works account which tries not to ignore the above-mentioned lacunae. Well, here it is. Kobylianska was a woman of the middle class, of considerable intellect and good, if informal, education. As a young woman, she reflected upon her strong sexual drives and her parallel desire for a suitable, socially sanctioned, heterosexual partnership expressed in marriage. Her desires were unmet, and she was unhappy. She thought deeply about the nature and causes of unhappiness and came to no conclusions beyond the inscrutability of human destiny. The diary, the more personal of the letters, and all of the imaginative works are linked by a vision of the human condition as tending powerfully, but not ineluctably, toward tragedy. This I would see as the basic pattern of all the works. Superimposed on it are the various social and cultural grids, present in different combinations at various points of Kobylenska's creative biography, which have mainly exercised the critics. The grid of fin de siècle ideas and styles, the grids of middle class and peasant society and their many concerns, the grid of the decline of a multi-ethnic empire, and the rise of national causes. So great has been the attachment of criticism to these grids that those works where they are less in evidence and the essential issues are closer to the surface, Через кладку and за ситуаціями, have received scant attention. Having distinguished between an essential Olha Kobylenska and the various guises that she adopts in order to be understood, we might have little alternative but to apply a label to her basic worldview, calling her, for example, a near pessimist. In her almost but not quite tragic world, the meaning of the self can be anchored only in a special relationship with the other, and such a relationship can arise, but only as a matter of accident. No amount of virtue or labor can bring it about. On the other hand, we might wish to frame this worldview as a dismissive response to the challenge of Nietzschean Übermenschentum. You may will your own ascendancy over the will and the rabble, over the world and the rabble to your heart's content, but chances are that you will not get it. As for the guises of Kobylenska, the grids that I have mentioned, we might wish to explain these in terms of a rhetoric. Kobylenska was never a self-confident writer. On the contrary, so sensitive was she to the preferences of her interlocutors that she adapted her diction to what she imagined would be most palatable to them. She is often accommodating herself to the style of her addressee. And Oleksandra Kopacz has demonstrated in her analysis of the many styles of Kobylenska's letters that this is, in fact, the case. Kobylenska's diary and correspondence speak of the accommodations that she must make to family members, to friends, editors, and publishers. Even her decision to write in Ukrainian is an accommodation to her closest friends. So her imaginative works, too, accommodate themselves to various cultural customs and modes. This is yet another demonstration, this time at the formal level, of the sad tenuousness of the isolated self, the dependence of the self for its self-expression upon pre-existent codes, or codes generated elsewhere and by others. If we no longer like the idea of shelling a worldview out of a body of texts, of reading literature as a second philosophy, we might take another line, not necessarily contradictory to the first. We might read Kobylenska's opus as a critical inquiry into the conditions for coherence in the temporal world, an inquiry at the end of the realist age into the sustainability of links between cause and effect. We might observe that, for all of Kobylenska's use of inner monologue to create the illusion of the thought process as the source of human action, for all of her references to genetics and nurturing, in her works, as in her diary, there is never any predictive knowledge of what will happen next. Character changes and objective factors determine nothing. People and their doings remain mysterious, and events in general remain mysterious even after they have happened and working explanations of them have been adopted. What appears to the Naked Eye as a socio-psychological novel, a fictional but lifelike account of what happens as a consequence of social and psychological determinants, becomes its own opposite, a revelation of the mystery of what human beings are and do as individuals and groups. One rereads not only to re-understand, but also to re-evaluate. Re-evaluating a thing which has canonical value is complicated. The question is, should we continue to give our attention to Olha Kubilańska? This is not the same thing as asking whether we like Olha Kubilańska today, or whether we would buy her books if she were a new author. There is no point in trying to work out whether Kubilańska appeals to us. Perhaps she is boring. If she is, she might be like Franco and Homer, and unlike Shevchenko and Shakespeare. Such matters are irrelevant to discussions about the classics. When critics deal with the classics, they do not function as representatives of the public, trying to generalize the public taste and offering a prediction of the public judgment. Rather, they defend classics against public taste. They artificially remind hypothetical readers of rules by which the work became important and the circumstances in which this happened. They do this in order that the work and its values might continue to be intelligible, so that it might stimulate yet other responses. A classic is valuable in the first instance, not because it gives or gave readerly pleasure, but because it continues in a contemporary cultural context to have the potential for some people in some ways of becoming contemporary. I would argue that today we might be indifferent to the causes of much of the praise that was heaped upon Kubilańska in the past, the beauty of her nature descriptions that moved so many critics early in the 20th century, for example. But we might not be indifferent to the passion, movement, the mystery of some of her works, nor to the questions they ask about human fate and the special fate of women. And we might not be indifferent to the record of her young life in her diary, so familiar, it seems to us, with its sense of a radically secularized world, with its desiring and frustrated bodies and minds, with its economics and politics of power and compulsion, even in the intimate sphere. And some of us who are close to Ukrainian culture might not be indifferent to the debates which laid the foundation of Kubilańska's reception, because those debates about the relationship between populist authenticity and modernism and the possibility of their satisfactory integration are still incomplete. In Ukraine, intellectuals are still at the modernist-populist crossroads that Kubilańska seemed able to negotiate with fewer hang-ups than almost anyone. In this respect, she could be a role model. Hang-ups about localism and globalism did not concern her very much, leaving her free to be hung up, as in our better moments we might like to be, about the human condition. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Polishin, for a very interesting and stimulating talk. Stimulating, I say, because I think we're all stimulated, and because I sincerely hope that your talk will provoke more attention to Olha Kubilańska. I also want to thank all of you for attending today's lecture. I want to in particular thank the members of the family of Danilo Strug, to Oksana Strug, and to Mrs. Daria Husar for attending. And I want to thank everyone for their participation in this first Danilo Strug Memorial Lecture. And I also want to invite you to a reception that will be held in this building, but at the very opposite corner of it. You'll forgive me if I... If you imagine this building to be a rectangle, we are here, and the place the reception is taking place is indeed a round room, round visibly from the outside and the inside, and it is precisely on the opposite corner of the building. So if you go down the corridor and to the right, or if you walk around the building on the outside, that is where the reception is being held. I invite you all now to join us and our speaker for a little wine and cheese in the Croft Chapter House, as indicated. Thank you very much.